This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Last September, President Obama declared the Atlantic Coast's first marine national monument. It encompasses nearly 5,000 square miles of ocean, about 100 miles southeast of Massachusetts, and it's home to dramatic undersea mountains and canyons. Along the walls of those canyons live fragile and slow-growing deep-sea corals. Yes, New England has corals. Anyway, this past week, the Associated Press obtained a copy of a memo from Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke to President Trump, advising him to amend the designation to lift the ban on commercial fishing. Joining me now with some perspective on this latest turn of events is Tim Shank. He's an associate scientist with tenure at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and he studies exactly the kind of ecosystems this monument is intended to protect. Tim, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Heather. It's good to be here.
All right. You weren't necessarily in favor of the monument designation or the monument process when it was happening. Why not? And how are you feeling about this latest turn of events?
Yeah, that's right. I was rather indifferent to the monument construction to begin with. I've been working on these canyons ecosystems for over 5 years now. We surveyed almost half of the canyons that exist between Canada and North Carolina. There's about 90 of them, all told, and many of them much larger than the Grand Canyon. And they have fantastic ecosystems inside them, and we've been studying them for that for those 5 years. The monument was established really without a whole lot of input, either scientifically or from other stakeholders, the fishing industry and other folks. Really wasn't an open process. It was rather hastily put together, I'll say, and there was 7 months of review and discussion, but the boundaries, for example, were never given to the public and never therefore discussed openly. Very unlike how it was done in the Mid-Atlantic states. The Mid-Atlantic Regional Fisheries Management Council came together and had debate for 3 years before looking and making recommendations about protecting corals and canyons down there, which they successfully have done in 15 canyons, encompassing an area that's 38,000 square miles.
A much larger area. A total fishing ban in those areas?
I shouldn't say total. They have constructed the boundaries, taking the fishing input to make it such that they can continue to fish where they've been fishing. And so it really did not negatively impact the fishing industry to any great extent. What it did down there was to freeze the footprint of fishing for the foreseeable future. There wasn't a whole lot of thought, I think, that went into the monument. It started out of being five canyons, ended up being three canyons. It was several, maybe more than 10,000 square miles. Now it's less than 5,000 square miles. And so it was not that big of an area, this monument. It includes three canyons and four seamounts that are in our exclusive economic zone here in the U.S. I'm really focused on those coral ecosystems, those sponge ecosystems that are really provide a lot of natural resources for our country.
I'm talking with deep sea coral biologist Tim Shank about a marine national monument off the coast of New England and Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke's recommendation to lift the ban on commercial fishing in that area. If President Trump takes that advice and lifts the ban, what it essentially does is doesn't just say all fishing is allowed at any depths and any kind. What it does is put fishing back under the purview of the New England Fishery Management Council and federal officials. And they actually have been considering something similar to what you were describing in the Mid-Atlantic for a much larger area, not just the three or the five canyons in this one area, but for all of the canyons and seamounts in their area, where it's still being debated, still being modified, but kind of freezing the footprint of fishing and saying there wouldn't be any fishing. They considered one this summer that said below 600 meters, it might be a different depth.
Right.
Is that enough protection for the corals that you study? If you say, okay, you can fish above this depth, right, and around the edges of the canyons, you just can't dive deep into the canyons with your fishing gear.
Right, and that's a great question. That is the question, I think. And what we've been trying to do is provide those data to their Fisheries Management Council to know whether 500 meters is a good depth with which to fish, or 600 meters. The reality is, if you look closely at our data and where the fishing industry goes for their activities, they don't overlap very much at all. The corals are deeper than 500 meters for the most part, and the fishing takes place above 500 meters. Right, so there really isn't that much of a collision in that regard. What may be of concern is that in the future, when fishing capabilities goes deeper and deeper, or when stocks start to decrease in the shallows and they want to go deeper and deeper or switch to other species that are deeper, that will become an overlapping issue. What we really do know is how vulnerable these coral ecosystems are to fishing and other kinds of activities. It's amazing how we're learning how slow growing these corals are. They are microns a year. A coral that's just a foot tall can be several hundred years old. The oldest animal we know of in the deep sea is a deep water coral off of Hawaii that's over 4,500 years old.
4,500 year old animal.
Yes, and it's a colony, they're so fragile. If you knock those down with a bottom trawler or some sort of bottom gear, they're not going to come back and grow fast. And it's not just the coral you'd be losing. It would be all the animals that live on those corals. And that's what we really study here. There's over 2,000 known now, which over half have not been described yet because they're so new to us. We're just discovering them now. But there are all kinds of shrimp and crabs and worms and other things that live on these corals and need these corals. In fact, that's the only place we find these species is on these corals. A certain brittle star, for example, a sea star, will only live on a certain kind of coral or a certain species of coral. And so it's a very delicate, let's say, vulnerable sort of structural infrastructure or habitat that these corals are creating, that if we lose that, then we lose a tremendous amount of diversity. Why is that important? Well, it's for ecosystem services to us, frankly. We lose the corals, we would lose the juvenile fish that love to live near those corals and protected by the corals that the fishing industry wants to end up fishing when they get larger. These are nurseries for various places. And if we lose that diversity, we lose the proteins and the enzymes they may harbor with their adaptations of how they live together. And so that's what we're studying now is this cellular communication between animals live on the corals and the corals themselves, and how the corals refuse some animals to come on. Somehow, chemically, we think, or invite others to come on. And you can imagine the biomedical properties that may come out of this, that there may be things that are advantageous for accepting certain tissue types in humans. And I mean, I could go on and on about those potentials, but if we lose that diversity, we lose those potentials.
I'm talking with deep sea coral biologist Tim Shank. Tim, a lot of people recently have seen this picture that's been floating around social media. It's a picture of a small seahorse that's actually got its tail wrapped around a Q-tip. And it's really just an amazing statement about how pervasive plastic pollution and human impacts are in the ocean. When you're down there looking well below 600 meters, you know, this seems like a place that humans could not possibly have touched in any way. Do you ever see signs of human impacts there?
So we typically explore from 300 meters down to 3,000 meters, so a mile and a half down. And I'll say even at those deepest depths at the base of these canyons, we see trash, and we see all kinds of trash. In fact, we've seen so much trash, we're now studying the distribution of trash in these canyons. The canyons are amazing because they are conduits from shallow water into the deep sea. So things that come out of the Hudson River, for example, come down these canyons, and they eventually flow to the bottom of the canyons. And so whether that's nutrients that are good for animals or whether they're plastic bags and coffee cans that are not good for animals, we get both. And we see lots of plastic. We see lots of ceramics, magazines and newspapers and boxes and toilets and showers, engines, anything that can come off a ship.
Wow.
Gets jettisoned, we can find on the bottom. And so there's not a single canyon that we've looked at so far. We looked at over 40 of them that doesn't have trash in it.
That's not something that a marine monument designation is going to stop, right? On the other hand, even if President Trump lifts the fishing ban, the marine monument designation does still exist for this area of canyons and seamounts, and it does carry some other protections. This is one of the things that environmentalists argued was a reason why we needed a monument as opposed to just fishing regulations, that it bans any other commercial mining or exploitation in that area. How important is that aspect of the monument designation and those protections?
You know, that's a great question. Again, I think it's extremely important. I think that's probably more important to the vulnerability of coral ecosystems than to just fishing activities, right? Even with fishing activities as they are now, we do see fishing materials on the bottom. We see lobster pots that are old and gone, and crab pots that are still there. But I think when we look at, and I've studied the Gulf of Mexico deep water corals for 10 years now, and I can tell you the impact of the oil industry and exploration and extraction of oil in the Gulf has impacted coral communities.
I mean, are you talking about the Gulf oil spill's impact?
I am directly, and also just the activities of ships. In those areas, you have a ship that sits above those areas, or a platform that sits there for months to years. Things come off those platforms; it's inevitable, and so we do see quite a bit of trash in the Gulf of Mexico as well. And I think, you know, people are paying so much attention to the monument and Secretary Zinke's memos and whatnot, but there was also an executive order last April 28th, by the president. That's called Implementing an America First Offshore Energy Strategy, which also inside that executive order had a review of the monument, this monument we're talking about here, to look at its boundaries and for oil and energy exploration. And there's been very little talk about what's happening, the results of that executive order, and the Secretary of the Interior is looking into that, and the Secretary of Commerce. They're both looking into how we can look at having an America First priority for energy exploration off our Atlantic coast here. And I believe that this will impact the national monument and how it may change with the next memo from Zinke.
And even with that monument in place, you've already made the point that this monument covers, you know, in the single digits, a small handful of canyons and seamounts. And
yes,
there's a huge expanse of this kind of area all along the East Coast that doesn't have the protections of a Marine National Monument designation.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And many people don't really realize either that 5 years ago, 4 years ago, we didn't have any really good maps of these canyons. This is really America underwater. This is United States underwater. It's our property. And yet 5 years ago, we didn't have maps that existed of these places. We mapped these places in an effort to understand the communities that live there, frankly. And we got these maps in very high detail. And when we were doing that, we were able to, given the instrumentation on board our ships, we were able to see where methane was leaving the seafloor. Prior to these mapping surveys, we knew of two hydrocarbon seeps in the Atlantic, basically. And through this work we did over a course of 2 years, we show there's more than 500 of these seeps, natural petroleum seepage coming out of the seafloor at the base of these canyons. So we think that the area there is rife for oil exploration and extraction, and there's probably oil there, but that's going to have, I think, a major impact on the communities, ecosystems that live in those areas.
That's deep sea coral biologist Tim Shank. Tim, thank you so much.
Thank you.